child, young and wild, dreams in your eyes and the faith in your smile. Spirits high, rebel cry, you don't have wings but you know you can fly. Never quit, never doubt, you stand on your mountain and you scream and you shout. Look, you will find there ain't nobody gonna tell you what are you gonna do.
Non-stop rock talk with Tyson Friday.
Hey Mike, welcome to Non-Stop Rock Talk. How are you doing?
I'm doing good under the circumstances, but I'm doing good.
Good, man. It's really an honor to speak with you. I mean, I've been a fan dating back to the mid-80s when I first bought my vinyl copy of Pride, White Lines Pride. I still have that album to this day, and let me tell you, it's pretty worn out. I believe that the song Wait doesn't even, it's not even playable anymore. And on a side note, White Lion with Cinderella and Tanger was actually my first rock show at the CNE Grandstand in Toronto way back in the late 80s. So I think I still have that ticket stub somewhere. But with all that,
I probably even remember that show. I mean, yeah,
that's awesome. Yeah, it was a good show, man. It was like August, and it was nice out. And it was hot, just like that '80s rock stuff was the best in the summer when you went to a show, right? So,
that's the way it was back then, you know.
Exactly, man. So let's talk about your latest album entitled Second Time Around, which drops on May the 1st. This may be an odd question, but in the press release I received, you mentioned that, and I quote, "With every album I recorded or every tour I finished, I always came home with such more knowledge than when I started it." With this album, if you had to summarize it, what do you think was brought forth from the experience of recording Second Time Around?
Well, I mean, I've always, like what you just mentioned right there, you know, to me, this is an ongoing journey until I take, you know, my last musical breath, a trip down Tramp's Endless Highway, where each exit I pull off to take a break represents an album. And when I look back at my first solo album, 97, Capricorn, and now the 12th in 2020, I see the journey. It is as clear as crystal. You follow the same character. You're basically dealing with the same issues. Sometimes the issues are resolved. Sometimes the issues have gone worse, et cetera, et cetera. But it is reality from wake up till going to bed. And that is what I was going for, trying to make sure that I would stay myself from day one on and not having ever to go back and redo something. Myself represents Mike Tram and his life and his view in every single song. And where I am with these different albums, can you say, well, you know, he got over that hurdle, but now he's landed there and he's dealing with that and so on. So I wonder how it's going to be next time. At the same time, also, my way of songwriting has never changed, and I'm not aiming for changing it. I'm not aiming to be groundbreaking. I'm not aiming at going to new dimensions. I'm just staying my tramp and continuing the journey. This is just more of the same, but different.
Yeah, and I agree with that, because as I'm listening to this material, changes, I mean, changes within the songs, I still hear that same type of formula. It's just the music is a different style somewhat. You know what I mean? Like the guitars aren't up front as much. They are, but in a different way. And I really, really enjoyed that, especially listening to this album.
Well, I always try, you sometimes run out of how to describe the things and stuff like that. But I've come up with this, you know, silly metaphor or analogy of describing, you know, like, you know, I remember both my grandmother and then my mom took over this three-level spice rack she would have over the stove.
Yeah.
And there were, I remember, you know, they had names I couldn't remember and stuff like that, or even understand what it was. And later on, I figured out that I wanted to be something specific that, because my mom would explain to me that, well, I add this for a specific thing. It's not just a guessing game. I just sprinkle it over and then hope it's going to be right. So when I reach for cinnamon or cardamom or something else, that is exactly what I want. And I want those who follow my tramp and those who you know, feel that today I want to listen to my tramp to have that thing that you're reaching for that spice because you can taste it in your mouth, and that's what you want. And I don't want you then to bite into and say, that's not the spice, it's something else. You know, and the same thing with that. And that's all I want to do. I'm happy to be one of the spices that you don't use often, but when you use it, there is no doubt what it is.
That's fantastic. That's great analogy. I like that. That was good. So getting to the title, was there a special meaning behind that title second time around?
Yeah, well, actually, you know, almost contradicting a little bit of what I just said, some of these songs have been songs that for some reason or another, and I'm still trying to come up with one, have been pushed aside. So these are songs getting a second time. Actually, probably even half of the album are the original basic tracks that are pulled out and opened in my studio and sat there and listened. I said, what happened here? What distracted me there? And at the final stage of putting this together, I now have to, you know, come to the conclusion that there are some of my favorite songs of the songs that I've written. And I decided then that second time around would be a better title than something representing where I am and going, because it's really a standing still. And then just saying, listen, I'm going to just give it a second chance. I'm just going to give it, you know, a second look, a second run, and also let it prove itself, and instead of just always heading down the road that maybe in reality this could be going back and exit, and just saying there was something that happened here, but I didn't resolve it.
Right.
And so I mean, I'm creating my own little, you know, both fantasy, but it's all based on reality, my own little story, you know. Yeah. I even though it has absolutely nothing to do with it, I'm not sure if you know what I'm talking about, but you know, one of the first books Stephen King ever wrote, back in his high university days or college days, with a story called the Gunslinger of the Dark Tower.
Yeah, I'm familiar.
And it was put aside for a long, long time. But once he started doing it, and then he came out with a couple of books, and then he took 20 years break, and then he came out, you know, that gunslinger that's traveling through this wasteland through all these different books, sometimes I see myself as that.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's a great answer. So do you feel with this album, in retrospect to where you are musically today, do you think this album is a good representation of Mike Tramp in 2020 then? I mean, we all...
1,000%, because there's no... You know, the only difference in all the 12 solo albums is maybe just you can notice that, you know, both the evolution of technology, even though the first album is still starting in a digital age. So it's not like I'm Pink Floyd or the Beatles, but I am maturing with each album. I'm getting more confident with each album. You know, that's what I hear. But if you went back and you said, does the first album represent my tramp? And I say, 100%. And so what I basically said over the last couple of things I said is that, yes, I never wanted to go any further. here's another, you know, silly thing I'm saying. I am my own version of AC/DC. No, nothing bad about AC/DC. It's one of my favorite bands. But for some reason, they've decided to sound the same on every album.
Yes. That's so true. But that's not a bad thing, because that's what people, that's the formula, and that's people.
That's just what you, I mean, listen, I do admire bands that have been groundbreaking and always been at the frontier and coming back, and we need things like that.
Yeah.
I just don't want to be like that. Once I started landing back, and I don't, when I say back, it doesn't mean, it's just that during the 80s and half of the 90s, that was a searching time.
Yeah.
And so that once I started landing back, it became back to my work boots, my jeans, and my leather jacket. And it's sort of just been consistent there. You open the closet, you look at all the stuff that I have. That might be a lot, but it's all the same.
That's fantastic. I mean, I think going back to talking about the 80s, I mean, I always thought your lyrics were always above most back in that time. I mean, you chose more serious topics, and I always respected that. There was a real seriousness in those certain topics, and it was always conveyed in your vocal approach. I mean, I think back
to... Well, you know, of course, I appreciate you saying that. Then I don't have to bring it up in that way, but then once you opened it up, you know... I was speaking to someone else, and I was trying to say, without it sounding wrong, because I am so fortunate and so lucky that I experienced the 80s and that I got to the top and I saw all that kind of stuff. But along the way, there was a person inside me that was searching for who I really was. I came to America in 82. It was 100% fueled on wanting to be like David Lee Roth, write songs like Journey, be like Cheap Trick. I mean, this is what fueled me to be in here. Once White Lion hit it big and we started getting into that next level there, I started seeing a dilemma I was, you know, I started dealing with, and that was that I was not very good at playing the rock star behind the mirror sunglasses, the limousine, and playing a I'm not really here kind of role, where I found myself getting off early at the tour bus, getting in, sitting there, watching the PA system and the stage being built, asking all the roadies to the spot, pushing me away, says, hey man, you know, you ask too many questions. I have so much interest in all that kind of stuff. I had no interest in the backstage parties and all that other kinds of stuff. I know I was good on stage. I know that I fulfilled the role that I was as the front man and the singer of White Lion. But the dilemmas at times I was facing also with writing the lyrics, trying to was sitting there listening to Dave Lee Roth, Bon Jovi, or Bret Michaels, and saying, I can't write this. It's not who I am. It's not where I come from. But I understand that I'm the frontman of an American band that I have started. But I can write this kind of stuff. It didn't come easy for me. I had to create it, and I felt I was fake because I didn't really, you know, I didn't really feel that I was not very good at sexual innuendos. I never felt wanting to be that kind of person that constantly was speaking that kind of language. So it was always a bit of a not a physical fight, but a fight with trying to convince, you know, myself that I should just stick to my guns and you know, when you listen back and some of the songs, especially around the world that have survived, are songs like When the German Cry, Little Fighter, Cry for Freedom, a song that I wrote about apartheid, and when I told the band they had no idea what it meant. They had no idea about South Africa, what it meant, but it's because I was raised in Copenhagen, Denmark, in a very, you know, social and environment, you know, my mom raised me and my two brothers on Johnny Cash and Elvis and Bob Dylan. That's, you know, that's why my roots are folk music. But also in school and in the youth club that I was going to after school, we were very, very aware of the world. When I came to America in 82 and I formed the band with Vito and we started, it's almost like a wall came around and I was living the American world. Right. And nothing else matters.
Wow.
It was the 20 greatest years in my life. But when you ask me that specific question or you mention that thing, the fact of the matter is it is something that I was constantly dealing with. I couldn't write about tits and ass and red sports cars going down Sunset Boulevard. It did not fulfill me.
That's a great answer. And the song that I was actually alluding to, besides the other ones, besides Little Fighter and When the Children Cry and Cry for Freedom, was actually Broken Home, because when that song came out and I first heard it, and
there's another one,
and I listened to those lyrics, it bothered me. It was and the point was the way that your desperation in your voice as you sang that song, it was like, wow, because I couldn't fathom anything like that. I had my two parents and lived in my bubble, and hearing something like that was just, it really affected me. It was touching. Like, I was like, wow.
The thing is, you know, I mean, I grew up in a workers' neighborhood in Copenhagen, a very poor neighborhood and stuff like that. I probably 9 out of 10 of my schoolmates, my soccer friends, my karate buddies, all came from divorced homes. The fathers were sitting at the pub, you know, being drunk and stuff like that, et cetera, et cetera. When I presented that song to the band and stuff like that, you know. And, you know, record company and our guys and producers, and they were scared. This is 1989.
Yeah.
Do you know what? Only 3 years later, Pearl Jam would come out with Jeremy and MTV would embrace it. But in 89, sitting with big blonde hair and tight pants and colorful jackets, it was out of place.
Yeah, and... Do you think that image with a song like that might have hurt a band like?
Of course, and the same thing with Little Fighter. You know, I wanted to do it, and you know what? I understand that too. I'm partially, I wouldn't call it to blame, but it was the time. I was just, you know, a sheep caught in wolf's clothing or wolf in sheep's clothing. You know, I mean, whatever which you have it, I had my vision, you know, I had my ideas, but they didn't work together.
Right.
But somehow they ended up being together. Then I'm out there, the Little Fighter video, I mean, it's like almost like you need sunglasses. That's how colorful my clothes is. But the song, even though the song doesn't specifics talk about the Rainbow Warrior, the little fishing trawler that Greenpeace were trying to prevent French government from doing nuclear testing explosions down in New Zealand and blew the ship to pieces, has become a song for people struggling, has become a song for people in you know, returning from war without their legs, has become songs for people from, you know, in all different, than when I play the shows, says play Little Fighter, I'm a Little Fighter, and you know, so somehow the message still came across that, you know, this was the one against the big one, was against the system, against the government, was against wherever you were, you know, you were the one that were gonna, you know, survive in the long run and things like that, and be able to tell the tales around that. But the thing was, nobody was interested in the 80s to hear any kind of serious interview. Hence why Eddie Vedder would not have existed in the 80s.
Good point.
Nobody was interested in anybody standing on stage lecturing the people.
Yeah. I think with Little Fighter,
Georgia Tits, have a drink on us, you know, all the kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That's what you did from the stage. But when you're not good at that and don't sound good saying that, what do you say then?
That's a good point. I mean, I remember seeing the video for Little Fighter and didn't realize until after, later on, when I actually read the lyrics, because the video doesn't portray...
The video overpowers the song. You never get the point.
Yeah, you don't get the point. It's like it's all bright and, you know, you guys are on stage and the song sounds amazing, but it doesn't convey that point around where, like, a band like Metallica doing the song One, they were able to...
Exactly.
You know? They were able to convey that.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great point you're making there. But it also shows how out of tune, you know, both our managers and our record company... I mean, even though Vito and I are the songwriters and we have some sort of direction, there is a limit for us to, you know, be Roger Waters at the time where we're in and have, you know, the complete vision and standing there and being groundbreaking, you know. So whatever we get thrown at us, you know, we just think, okay, this is just promotion, that we're just carrying on where we left. But someone could actually come in and say, you know, it is 89 now. But, you know, the 80s killed the 80s.
Yes,
at the end, people just had too much of too much.
Yeah. Everybody just had enough and it's time to move on and let's look at something.
Exactly. Which basically why the word grunge should be is not the alternative. It's like people need now an alternative, you know? But the interesting thing was also like MTV was goading us to do videos like that.
Yeah.
These are the videos that built MTV. They didn't want stuff. Like, I even remember when we did Radar Love, you know, the record company sitting there, they're debating if we can ride the motorcycle without a helmet. You know, so the rebellion wasn't there. It was a controlled rebellion.
Yeah. That's crazy. That's crazy. I mean, you're kind of pigeonholed, right? Into...
Well, I mean, yeah, and at that time, who the hell is going to go against the grain?
That's true.
You're in many ways so afraid of losing your rank and your position that you sort of just continue with what you've just done.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, more of the same.
Yeah, and luckily you were able
But you see, for example, that then when we get, because it backfired a bit on us, we've been on the road for 2.5 years with the Pride album, et cetera, et cetera. When we get, you know, if ever there was a band that needed a break, it was Vito and I and White Lion. But we never got a chance to just let it all just fade away before we started writing. We got sort of like pushed into that. And Vito and I actually wrote the Big Game album in 2 weeks in a motel in Palm Springs, California, where we'd written Pride over 3 years. Which meant that we even though it's got some great songs, it's an unfinished album. It's an unfinished album. So when we took the break and we started writing for the final album, Main Attraction, you see the amount of words Vito and I put in there, and it becomes a dark album in many ways. And we're trying to sort of recover or maybe in reality land the band of where we wanted to go. You mentioned it before. You can look at a Circus magazine or Hit Parade in 1988, and almost every band looks the same. Now you can take a box of albums from the 80s and a lot of the covers look the same. Now you can take the vinyl out and put on your turntable. This is where it separates.
Yeah.
White Line does not sound like Poison,
no.
Cinderella, or Rat.
No, definitely not.
And already from the start, as much as Vito and I had a similar to David Roth and Eddie Van Halen, we didn't sound like them. We were on our way to wanting to become a much more like a Journey or that kind of album, a bigger album, a song kind of band, and a more instrumental musical band than a you know, tits and ass, you know, shake your butt glam band.
I think for me, I think I had Big Game and Pride on last night. I was listening to my vinyls, And I actually have two copies of Pride. I had to buy a new one, but I still have that original one. But anyways, you hit the nail on the head. You listen to those albums. The guitar is different. The vocals, the lyrics are different. And yeah, it stands out. It really does stand out. And today, listening to some of those topics on those songs, it really makes sense. And, you know, because today's a whole different time, right? So it's kind
of... You know, it is. I mean, you know, I wrote When the Children Cry in 1985. I mean, if you just look at that for a second, Ronald Reagan is the president. Basically, some people would you know, contradict, because there's always someone want to contradict, but 85, America is probably at the top of their game. Overall, people are happy. Concerts are max capacity. Albums are selling bigger than ever. Rock and roll is just on every single radio station. People are happy. You look out from the stage. You look from the audience to the stage. There's happiness everywhere. And I'm sitting at my manager's house in Staten Island, New York, where I was living, writing, "No more precedent, and all the wars will end. One united world under God." That's a kid from Denmark in 1985 with his big hair and probably some tight pants and cowboy boots, sitting there with his Dylan Martin guitar writing that song.
That's fantastic.
Without thinking, you know, and every band has ballads in the 80s, Home Sweet Home, yep, and all stuff like that, and here comes When the Children Cry.
Yep.
Those lyrics are stronger today, and they will be even stronger tomorrow than they were in 1985 or 1988 when it became a hit.
Yeah. Wow. That's awesome. Would you say, like, Broken Heart, which was originally on Fight to Survive, was that the band's intention to actually redo that song at some point on an Atlantic?
No, we were completely against that. This is not, you know, this is what eventually leads to me ending the band on September 2nd, 91, at our final show at Boston. Vito and I had not any problems writing songs. Mm-hmm. And we felt it was a step back. We understood, and that's the song, first song Vito and I ever wrote. That's the start of White Line. The song was always part of our life set from the start to the finish. We knew it was a great song. It's a very simple song, but it's a powerful, classic rock and roll song. But we did not need it there again. But this is once again, we had a new producer on the album, Rich Aceto. Our record company was kind of saying, you know, in lack of better ideas, because they had no fucking ideas of what they wanted to do. It's like stupid comments and things like that. And, you know, eventually Vito and I got sort of like, you know, overpowered to redo the song and things like that. Yeah. And you know, we could just do without it. We could just do without it.
Yeah, and that's why I asked.
And it just started getting me bitter, and adding some other things to, you know, finally, you know, I told Vito, man, you know, this is going to be a final show, and Vito just looked at me and says, okay, and he and I built that band, and you know, we parted as friends, and we didn't speak about it for almost 20 years.
Wow, that's crazy. I mean, that was a great album. Definitely was, from top to bottom. But
it is a great album. It's not that I'm gonna pat myself on the back or want to be patted on the back. How many bands from that decade opens up with a 10-minute song called, you know, Life and Thunder?
Yeah. That's an amazing tune.
But again, for Vito and I, it was just a statement that that's where we were as a musical band.
Yeah. And I think that song kind of said, here's the album, this is the first track, and it just, I mean, it just kept going from there. It was just a solid album from front to back. And even lyrical content on that one, too, is fantastic as well. So it is, It may be my favorite White Lion album, to be honest with you.
Well, I mean, that's great. I mean, you know, we were, you and I are happy that we finished on that album, things like that. That album should actually have been where Big Game was.
Yeah.
If we had had that year, or at least half a year, to breathe and started just not hearing weight in our head and not hearing that and maybe not watching MTV, but just getting back to how Vito and I used to write, me sitting there with my acoustic guitar being Dylan and Vito sitting there across him with a Strat being, you know, what he was, and then the song meeting in the middle. That's where we were, how we were writing songs.
Mm-hmm.
But we never really got a chance to come down from the high horse. We were burned out when we drove out to, you know, a almost deserted motel in Palm Springs and set up a little 4-track cassette studio and started writing these songs.
That's cool. Now, let's. I guess we kind of got off on. We started talking about White Lion, and I wanted to talk more about the album, but we kind of went off on that. But I want to ask you about The Road. That song is. I love it. I've probably listened to it like 3 or 4 times in the last day, and it's got a cool. I think more of a rock approach with a little bit of an Americana vibe. I think the guitar is really cool on that. What was your approach on that song?
That's like, excuse my language, like scratching my ass. I mean, it's like one of the most simple things. It is like 1,000,000% my tram DNA. The simple way of writing, I can trace that song down back to probably my childhood of hearing Knocking on Heaven's Door or some of the Danish folk artists in the late 60s that I grew up on when I was sitting and sort of like, you know, trying to learn these simple songs like Have You Ever Seen the Rain, Creedence Clearwater Revival, or those kind of songs.
Yeah.
And then just attaching the lyrics, which is sort of, I'm not saying end of the road, but you know, you sort of gotten to the, you've come to the conclusion now that you basically know the journey, even though the journey is going to continue, it's sort of going to remain there. But now when you look back, you know that the road that makes you is the road that breaks you. And all these things in get out there, live the life, learn it the proper way. No shortcuts. Don't jump the queue, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm even more pleased that in just 4 hours together with a friend, I could put a video together on my farm that just represents me 100%. And people pay attention to these small things that happen, which are the most natural things, you know? And you know, this guy was saying, thank you for inviting us in to your private life. And says, all I wanted to do was this video was just be me. Which basically I've been on all my solo album videos and things like that. Yeah. But you know, I can't come up with a concept. How about if you just film me?
It's a good video. I've watched it a couple of times too, and I enjoyed it. So job well done. It looks good. Who's singing? Who's the girl singing on the background vocals?
Yeah, that's my bass player's wife. She's basically been singing on most of my solo albums, the last 10 solo albums, which basically been the same players in and out. Even though you know, I understood and I learned my final lesson in 2010 that it's impossible to put a permanent band together.
Mm-hmm.
I do like the comfort of my friends, the people that I love, and the people that I like the way they're playing, to constantly be part of my albums. And I think probably because we keep it this way is why we're still very, very strong friends, because, you know, they're not the conflict between, because I run this project, this band, my tram, with an iron hand, and, you know, this is my life. There's nobody else that's going to have any say in it. You know, I paid my dues and now I'm going to guard it.
Oh, that's great. So I understand the album will be available for download, CD, and 500 copies will be available on red vinyl with pre-orders. And I'm going to put this out there, being personally signed by you through Target.
I appreciate that.
.dk. As well, 100 copies will include a second time around t-shirt. So I'll just throw that out there. And so if people are interested in buying the album, and I mean, I'm going to vouch for the fact that I really enjoyed it, and it's
yeah, you know, it's a long way from you know, the record store in store signing sessions with, you know, 1,000 people down the block. You know,
yeah.
It's a long way just from the record store.
Yeah,
you know, now it's just the way it is, and that's fine. I sell a lot of albums after the show when I come out and meet the people and stuff like that, and I'm fine with where it is. I'm fine with where it is. I have built my life as in many ways as a minimalist. You know, I just need you know, water and air and a pair of good boots, jeans and a leather jacket and a Martin guitar and a Telecaster and you know.
And you're good to go.
Actually, that was a lot of things.
So before I let you go. I mean, it's hard to tell with everything that's going on in the world right now.
Yeah.
In terms of touring plans, I guess everything's kind of on hold right now.
Yeah, you know, it goes for everyone. It doesn't just, you know, I mean, it's actually the first time where one sort of, I'm not sure, you know, that I'm okay with, you know, the word canceling, or we could call it postponed shows, because at the same time, the venue is also closing down.
Yeah.
So it's a joint effort. Together with the fans, everybody's closing down. So, you know, what was to be my North America tour starting April 15 will now start, you know, probably the last week of August, if the world is sort of back to semi-normal at that time. I don't think the world will ever be back to normal, but it will be back some way or another.
Right. Okay. Well, that's good to know. Hopefully you'll be coming to Canada, because that's where I am. And
yes, I know. I mean, I've had offers from Canada. And I think the way to do it is to do a specific Canada tour.
Right. Cool. Okay. Well, hopefully I'll see you out here. But Mike, I wish you the best of luck with this album, and I thank you so much for your time.
I appreciate for your support and bringing the message out to your audience and stuff like that. And, we'll meet down the road.
Okay, perfect. Thanks, Mike. You have a good day.
Thanks a lot, buddy.
Okay, take care.
Appreciate it.
Chose black and you chose white.